Okay, everybody. Well, Happy New Year, firstly. Although I'm told by Howard Davis it's not going to be a Happy New Year. But there you go. First of all, let me introduce myself. My name is Professor Mick Cox. I'm in the Department of International Relations. I'm one of the co-directors or directors of IDEAS here, which was established 11 months ago to further the study of international relations, strategy and diplomacy here at the LSE, in conjunction with a number of departments here at the LSE, including the Department of International Relations, which has given us an enormous amount of support. And it's very nice to welcome the convener of the Department of International Relations here this evening, Professor Christopher Coker. This is the opening session in what we hope will be, and almost and certainly predict will be, a very successful project or program looking at the transatlantic relationship this year and into the future. So my congratulations to all of those postgraduates here in IDEAS and in the university who have contributed to this program. I'll mention some of them later on. They're all in the audience here this evening, but they've done a terrific job and really, I think, show the symbiosis between faculty and the PhDs here at the LSE and hopefully and through the IDEAS Centre of Diplomacy. I'd also like to say thank you to the Grimshaw Club, the most funny named club in the world, I think, Grimshaw. I'm not quite sure what Grimshaw ever means. It kind of sounds fairly grim, but it's one of the oldest clubs in the university, I think, established in the 1920s and associated with the international relations, who are also supporting this particular meeting this evening. As I say, this event is part of the 2008-09 launch of the transatlantic program. I'm also equally delighted to welcome two, I wouldn't say very old friends, but good and old friends, not very old friends, here this evening, whom I've worked with over many years, Charlie Kupchan to my right, and Tom Carruthers to my left. I mean, neither, I think, to an audience like this needs very much introduction. Charlie is professor at Georgetown, also senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. Charlie has written, I think, with great skill, great verve, and I'm glad to say a great controversy on the question of the American era, the nature of the West, the nature of the transatlantic relationship. We've met in several places, some of them alcohol-free, over the past few years, and it's just great to bring you
here.
Which
one was alcohol-free?
I can't remember. I don't know. we'll try and make sure we don't break that okay. Particular movement tonight. But anyway, it's great to have you here this evening, Charlie. Absolutely fantastic. And also equally great to have Tom Carruthers here this evening. I first met Tom, I think, in Washington. It was in 1998 when I was then working with John Eikenberry, a common friend of all of ours, and Takashi Noguchi, a fine Japanese scholar, and we worked on a project on American democracy promotion, which was published in 2000, and Tom supported us there at the Carnegie in Washington. So Tom's going to make a few comments at the end in relationship and in response to what Charlie has here to say. The title, of course, is typically crisis-ridden, The West, Last Gasp or Making a Comeback. Charlie's already given me the answer to the question, and just to give you a hint, it may be the last gasp. And I've got a long blurb here written for me, I think, by some of the students of Times of Disharmony in the Bush Years. Obama's new hope for transatlantic relations. Will those hopes be realized? We're not too sure, but Charlie, you're going to tell us now whether or not it is the last gasp or are we making a comeback. Charlie, you're more than welcome to the LSE and to IDEAS.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here and to join you for the launch of what I hope will turn into a rich and productive project on the Atlantic relationship. I'm going to tell a tale or a story tonight that comes in three chapters. The first chapter will be directly about the West as a political community, and I will offer an evaluation of the health of that political community, which is generally upbeat in the sense that I think that the transatlantic community, the West as it were, is in much better shape today than I would have predicted it to be in, let's say, 4 years ago when Bush was reelected. The recovery of that relationship suggests to me that there is a an equilibrium resting point that is reasonably stable and reasonably cooperative. At the same time, I want to suggest that the West has passed through a historical breakpoint, that the spats between the United States and Europe over Iraq, over detainees, over Russia, over Georgia, over NATO enlargement, over missile defense, are not passing spats that were a byproduct of the Bush administration. They are here to stay. American and European interests have diverged sufficiently that one can no longer talk about American and European security as being indivisible. So the central message I want to leave with you on part one, or chapter one, is as long as we revise downward our expectations and see the Atlantic community as more of a normal friendship rather than some closely knit alliance, then I think we will have our expectations met. But let's just be realistic and appropriately sober about the scope and the reach of the Atlantic Alliance. I then want to look a little bit at Europe and at the United States internally, because I think that in many respects the key challenges to the future of the West are more what happens within the European Union. Will the European Union continue to prosper? And then I want to say a few things about the Obama administration and where I expect it to head on foreign policy, because I think these are two issues that are of central importance to figuring out whither the West. And then the third chapter, I want to say a little bit about the West and the rest, because it is day by day increasingly irrelevant to discuss the transatlantic community without talking about the rest of the world. And I think that we are passing through a moment in which the West is losing its pride of place as the centering formation in the international system. And that as we continue to witness the rise of Russia, of China, of India, of Indonesia, of Brazil, the West will remain an important political community, but it will no longer provide the anchoring principles of the international system. And in that sense, I think figuring out what that next order will look like is a critical question for all of us, because I do not think it will look like the West. So let me take about 10 minutes or so on each of those three chapters. As far as the transatlantic relationship goes, I'm someone that is sufficiently realist in orientation and sufficiently mindful of the power of international structure to believe that with the end of the Cold War, the Atlantic Alliance was destined to suffer a serious degradation. And I don't think that there's anything that one can do about it. Now, that degradation was mightily exacerbated by political decision makers on both sides of the Atlantic, although I would apportion more blame on my side of the Atlantic than on this side of the Atlantic. But even under the best of circumstances, I think we were facing inevitable structural pressures that would lead to a break point, a move away from the tight-knit alliance-slash-security community of the 1941 to end of Soviet Union, but let's just be nice to Bill Clinton and date the arrival of George Bush on September 11 as the closing of that era. And those conditions, those inevitable forces are ones that I think most people are quite aware of. The absence of a common external threat. The fact that front and center on the transatlantic agenda were those issues over which Americans and Europeans have historically disagreed. Iran, Iraq, Palestine, Israel. We always disagreed about these issues, but during the Cold War, the Soviets were threatening the inner German border, so we were able to sublimate these disagreements. They were sideshows. Well, after the Soviet Union falls apart, those sideshows become the main agenda. And therefore, we have much more difficulty reaching a meeting of the minds on the core issues facing the transatlantic alliance, because these are issues where there simply isn't the same coincidence of interest and the same coincidence of perspective. And that is not an issue of decision-making, mistakes, bad diplomacy. It's simply reality. I think one can add to that a set of changes that have expedited or deepened the divergence. One is a demographic change, that the United States is day by day becoming less European in its population. In the American demographic scene, Americans under 20 years of age, a majority of those Americans are minorities. A majority of those Americans do not come from Europe, do not trace their ancestry to Europe. That means within one generation, less than 50% of the American population will have ancestral roots in Europe. Most of the people who are replacing the Europeans are Hispanics, and then blacks and Asians are the other major sectors that are fundamentally changing the complexion of the American population. That doesn't mean a devaluing of the Atlantic link, but I think it does mean that an increase in the American attention span politically, political capital, economically, will be focused on the Western Hemisphere, and that will to some extent come at the expense of the attention paid to Europe. I think it's also coupled with a generational change, that there is in Europe and in the United States an effective passing of the baton from the generation that either lived through World War II or the rebuilding of Europe to a generation such as that of Barack Obama, who has come of age in an era in which the Cold War is almost a thing of the past. I mean, he was an adult before the fall of the Berlin Wall. I am basically of the same generation of Barack Obama, and sort of I went to grad school during the period in which the Cold War was still on. I began life as an assistant professor as the whole thing was unraveling. But people who are one generation older than me are the sort of Atlanticists, dyed-in-the-wool, deeply embedded. What happened between Washington and Berlin, or Washington and Bonn, could have never happened between George H.W. Bush and Helmut Kohl. It simply was not possible. That Germany broke with the United States on matters of peace and war, that was, I think, fundamentally a function of the fact that for younger Germans, the alliance with the United States isn't as sacred as it was for the older generation of Germans. And so there is a sort of inside-out change that is coupled with the end of the Cold War, differing views of the threat posed by Islamic extremism and terrorism, parting of the ways on how to deal with Russia, a whole host of diverging interests that say to me, not that the United States and the European Union are going to be competitors, but that we're just going to be more normal friends. We'll have good days and we'll have bad days. We'll agree sometimes and we'll disagree other times. And it seems to me that the trick is realizing that, accepting that, recognizing that, and moving to a world in which we don't bemoan the fact that we have good days and bad days, but that we make the most of a partnership that is simply less tight, less taken for granted, less close than it was during the Cold War. Let me also say that, as I said at the beginning, that I think the recovery that the Atlantic community has made during Bush's second term is quite striking. And that this was, in my mind, a reality check, a sort of reaction to the degree to which both sides looked over the precipice. Both sides imagined the world without the Atlantic community, and they didn't really like what they found. The Bush administration, in its first term, figured it could run the world on its own, and that Europeans should either follow or get out of the way. And Europeans generally said, good riddance. We really don't need our American protector. We want a multipolar world. We are now exercising our more muscular approach to international governance, and let's get on with it. Well, both sides realized that those views were inaccurate. The Americans woke up one day and found the world a very lonely and dangerous place and looked to Europe to help bail them out. And I think many Europeans, rather than facing a Europe that was self-confident and ready to move on with its own history, found themselves deeply divided over whether to let go of or try to repair the Atlantic link. And it speaks volumes to me that even though people like Schroeder and Chirac got a short bump in their popularity for standing up to Bush and saying enough of Pax Americana, they were both replaced by Atlanticist leaders, and that Europe today is much more Atlanticist than it was earlier. So it seems to me that there is a corrective mechanism that operated on both sides of the Atlantic that gives us reason to be optimistic that there is a stickiness, that there is a natural affinity that will serve us well. But again, let's be sober about the affinity. Let's not kid ourselves that economic interdependence will keep us together. We know it won't. Let's not kid ourselves that democracies always agree on foreign policy, because we know they don't. We know that even within the EU, not to mention within the Transatlantic Alliance, there isn't a consensus about whether to recognize Kosovo, about how to deal with Russia's invasion of Georgia, and about many, many other issues. Are democracies more likely to share common views with other democracies than with non-democracies? Probably. Probably so. But that certainly doesn't mean that there is always a coincidence of interest that's based on common regime type. So I leave Chapter 1 with a relatively upbeat assessment. The transatlantic community, the West, was sorely tested by the events of the last 8 years. It has rebounded from the low points of 2003-2004. Americans and Europeans alike have realized that they remain each other's best partners. And I think the efforts of European governments as well as the new government in the United States will be indicative of that confidence that the West is still a meaningful political community and that both sides should invest in its future. Again, the caveat being, let's look at it through a realistic perspective. Let's accept that it will be a friendship, that we will have good days and bad days, but that it will not look like the Atlantic Alliance of the good old days. The second chapter of this story is to step back a little bit and look at the two component parts of this narrative and to say, well, what's going on in Europe and what's going on in the United States? And here I'm somewhat worried that the developments that are in train in Europe and the developments that are in train in the United States are not necessarily auspicious ones from the perspective of revitalizing the Atlantic link. And the core of this observation would be that the United States today is very much in help mode. We, to put it in political science jargon, are in deep doo-doo. Our country's economy is generally heading down the toilet. We are in Afghanistan, not quite sure what we're doing. Iraq has stabilized, but nobody knows what's going to happen when we start pulling out several combat brigades over a fairly fixed and rather rapid time schedule. There's a war going on in the Gaza Strip that nobody knows how to stop. No one knows what its long-term implications will be. And therefore, there is a palpable sense in America's political class and in the American public that we need help. In Europe, I think there's a sense that the United States is coming calling. It will have its cup in its hand. It will be asking for contributions on many different fronts. And I think the question that Europeans face is, will Europe be up to the task? And it seems to me that the answer is, at least for the foreseeable future, probably not. And that's simply because Europe will not be able to make the concrete contributions that the United States would like from it unless it does a better job of aggregating its voice and its capabilities. And as someone who was 3, 4, 5 years ago quite bullish about the European Union, I'm now someone who is much more skeptical, or at least much more guarded in my optimism about the European experiment. I would say that the experiment has recovered somewhat from the dire predicament in which it found itself about a year ago in the aftermath of the failure of the Constitution and the Irish no vote. But I do think that there are a series of rather worrying developments that make it, in my mind, a reasonable proposition that the European project has reached its high watermark and that it will go no further. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. If Europe stays where it is, it's still a geopolitical revolution of historic proportions. But it's not the entity or the actor that the United States would like for sharing global burdens. The sorts of challenges that I think Europe has to deal with, and they're familiar to all of you, range from the question of immigration and the integration of Muslims into the social mainstream, structural adjustment and economic liberalization, particularly during a period of economic decline, the fatigue or the blowback from enlargement that has gone quickly and widely. And I think all of this has added up to a renationalization of political life across the European Union. As someone who comes to Europe on a reasonably often basis, once every few months, one can feel it. One can feel it across the various member states of the EU. That doesn't, in my mind, suggest to me that the EU is done for or that it's in crisis, but it does suggest to me that, at least for now, there is little forward momentum. And it raises questions about whether the necessary centralization, the necessary collectivization of capability and political will the United States will hope for will be forthcoming. On the American side, I would say the biggest concern that I have moving forward, and this is sort of coming the other direction, what does Europe want from the United States? The biggest concern I have is whether Obama will be able to reconstruct the bipartisan center in American political life. And there's a long conversation here and discussed it at RUSI earlier today, but I think that what made possible the liberal internationalist consensus that guided American foreign policy from Roosevelt through Clinton was bipartisanship. It was a coalition of centrist and moderate Republicans and centrist and moderate Democrats that was cobbled together for the first time in American history by Franklin Roosevelt. And it was then replicated by each president that came after him, right through Bill Clinton. And it was that center that provided a political foundation, in part for ideological reasons. It was moderate, it was centrist, it believed in combining power in partnership, but also because, to recapture the famous phrase of Arthur Vandenberg, Democrats and Republicans alike agreed that politics stops at the water's edge, and that you can fight with each other and bloody each other over stem cell research, over gay marriage, over smoking and whether it should be banned from restaurants. But when it comes to national security, we're all Americans. That attitude and that bipartisan spirit has disappeared. It's gone. And if you look at voting patterns in Congress or you look at public opinion, the United States is now more polarized on foreign policy than on domestic policy. And the number crunchers, the political scientists who study voting patterns, find that the United States is more polarized today, ideologically and politically, than at any time since the late 19th century. And Obama says there's no red America and there's no blue America, there's just the United States of America. And it is true that Virginia and North Carolina and Nevada and New Mexico, red states, voted for Obama. And so you may be saying, aha, he's right. America is purple. It's not red or blue. Well, the only problem is this was a very idiosyncratic election. It was an election that was very much against Bush and against the war, against McCain and his pick of Sarah Palin, and it was about the financial crisis. It was not, in my mind, a fundamental realignment in the American electorate that would suggest that we're now seeing the reemergence of a bipartisan America. If anything, I would say that the United States is getting more and more balkanized politically. Just as one quick example, does anyone know, and you can't answer this because we just went through this, how many Republicans are there in the congressional delegation that New England sends to Washington? There are zero. Because the one that was there before lost. Right? So here's a major part of the country, and it doesn't have a single Republican in its congressional delegation. And you may say, well, big deal. Well, that is a big deal. Why? Because it means that different parts of the country are becoming wedded to a single political party. And in American history, when that happens, we have big trouble. Perhaps the most famous time that that happened was in 1855. What happened in 1855? The South effectively overturned the Missouri Compromise. The Missouri Compromise was the deal that the North and the South struck to deal with slavery. One free state for every slave state that entered the Union. And before 1855, if you looked at New England, you'd see the parties weren't called this at the time, but half, you know, good representation of Republicans, good representation of Democrats, and the same from the South. And that meant that the parties had to run to the center because you had to keep both Northerners and Southerners happy. Well, after the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, the Democrats became the party of the South, the Republicans became the party of the North, and the Civil War broke out 6 years later. And that's because neither party had any electoral incentive to compromise with the other because they only represented a unique political constituency. That same phenomenon is happening today. Part of it is because of redistricting. Part of it is because the industrial mixing bowl is being reversed by the digital economy and people can now live where they want to live rather than where they have to live. But in many respects, we are seeing an America that is becoming more homogeneous regionally, not one that is becoming more heterogeneous as a national community. And that simply leaves me worried that despite Obama's best instincts, despite Hillary Clinton, despite a Republican Secretary of Defense, it's going to be bloody difficult to put Humpty Dumpty back on the wall. And that's because Republicans and Democrats don't agree on very much. It's because to breathe new life into liberal internationalism, you need the Senate. Keep in mind that any treaty, any institution, any legally binding commitment in the United States requires 67 senators, two-thirds. How many liberal internationalists are there left in the Republican Party? 1.5? Maybe 2 if you're being liberal? So that's just a cautionary note about the difficulties that Obama is going to face as he tries to recraft American foreign policy towards the brand of internationalism that Europeans are hoping for. Final chapter. What about the rest of the world? The dominant narrative in the United States, and I don't know whether it pertains here or not, but I'd be interested to find out, is that there is a recognition that a multipolar world is coming. I published a book called The End of the American Era in 2002, and I would say at that time I was alone and somewhat of a heretic. I would say it's now the conventional wisdom. I mean, even someone like Fareed Zakaria, who I think you can consider to be a kind of very centrist establishment figure, just published a book called The Post-American World. So there's a recognition among, I would say, the mainstream, politically and intellectually, that American primacy is waning. There is also a consensus, I would say, that the task before the West, while it still enjoys primacy, is to universalize the Western order by bringing in rising powers. And I would say that the most elegant and articulate proponent of this would be our friend John Eikenberry. And I think Mick and I both love John Eikenberry, but we both realize that he's wrong. But we just don't tell him that too frontally. No. And I think he's wrong for a very simple reason. And that is that when rising powers rise, they don't join the existing international system. They want to recast the international system in ways that are conducive to and compatible with their own interests and their own way of doing business. And so it seems to me that the idea that the Western order is a Rawlsian order, that is to say that behind the veil of ignorance we would all arrive at the Western order, is naive. And that there is no, in my mind, historical reason or theoretical reason to believe that the West, the U.S., the Europeans, the version of liberal democracy, the liberal internationalism that the West has created, will enjoy universal support. And John and others, there was something called the Princeton Project that he and Anne-Marie Slaughter co-authored. Anne-Marie Slaughter is about to become the director of policy planning. This report was called something like Liberty Under Law. And the idea was that we will spread the Western order. We will spread liberal democracy. We will spread international institutions and open markets. And we will open the door to the Russians, to the Chinese, and they will take their seat at our table. I just don't think it's going to work that way. It seems to me that there is a next order that can be negotiated, but the West is going to have to give as much as it gets. It's going to have to accept that there is no single political formula for how societies should govern themselves. And as part of this idea of universalizing the West, John and Anne-Marie and others, others including on the left, the center-left of the political spectrum, have proposed this idea of a League of Democracies. that the UN really doesn't work because the Chinese are there and the Russians are there and they keep vetoing our wonderful proposals. So what we need to do is create an alternative forum where the autocracies of the world will not be present. And it seems to me that that is exactly the wrong move at this point in time, when we need to get together and try to figure out an inclusive political order in which Western democracy and open markets and laissez-faire systems of economic management will not enjoy universal support or universal existence. And so I would simply say that when we think about the West and we think about its future, let's also think about how we may have to compromise on some of our own principles, on some of our own values and beliefs, as we move to a world that will not just be multipolar in terms of the distribution of power, but diverse in terms of the types of political systems that populate the international system. And I think one important issue that we need to engage in that respect is who should be in and who should be out, what states should be in good standing. And in a paper that I've been working on with a grad student at Georgetown named Adam Mount, we've suggested that states in good standing should be not just those that are liberal democracies, but those that are that govern so as to promote the welfare of their societies and to promote the autonomy of their citizens to fulfill and pursue their aspirations, whether they be democratic or not. And that means that there are different ways of approaching autonomy and of approaching and modeling and benchmarking good governance. And so I think that, and this will be my final thought, that perhaps it's time for the West to spend less time thinking about itself and its own internal constitution and more time figuring out what kind of bargains, what kind of principles, what kind of norms the West should put on offer to the rest of the world as it begins to negotiate the nature of a new order. And it will be an order that no longer relies upon Washington and Europe as the center of gravity, as the source of legitimacy and authority. And it's going to be hard, I think, for the West to get used to it, but recognizing that is, in my mind, an important step in getting to a next order peacefully and by design, rather than perhaps not so peacefully and by default. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Great. And Tom, we'll pass it over to you for a few well-chosen comments.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks very much, and I appreciate the invitation and congratulate you also on the establishment of this center and wish you every success. I tend to agree with Charlie on most things, but that's not very entertaining.
No, we didn't bring you along to do that.
Exactly. So let me at least try to add, and they're really more just sort of reflections on some of the things he said, not really sharp disagreements, but just slightly different perspectives on certain things. Let me just go through each of his three areas in turn. First, with respect to the degradation of U.S.-European relations and its inevitability, I agree with the spirit of what you say, but I think I would actually be a bit tougher and say that I wouldn't place it at the start of the Bush administration. I would go back a bit earlier into the Clinton years, because it's surprising when one goes back and looks at some of the literature in the second half of the 1990s, there's quite a bit of writing about U.S.-European conflict. We remember, for example, Samuel Huntington writing a quite prominent article in Foreign Affairs in the late 1990s called The Lonely Superpower, about how the United States was not getting along well with other countries in the world, including Europe. And there were a whole series of disputes, like the International Criminal Court over Israel, over the Kyoto Protocol, and quite a few other things that were dividing the United States and Europe already. So I think certainly President Bush gets plenty of blame for exacerbating what was already an existing tendency, but I think we can date it even earlier. And in some ways, we can imagine U.S.-European relations in the coming decade being more like the 90s, sort of the kind of a frictive friendship, the type that you described. I think what's interesting when we look at what happened in this decade and the degradation that really did become exacerbated is we tend to point immediately to President Bush and the the intervention in Iraq and say that this is really the dividing point and really broke apart the U.S.-European relationship. And certainly the damage was tremendous, and it was very important. But what's interesting is there was also in this decade, it sort of came about after that occurred among many, within European societies more than just sort of governmental relations, was a strong sense that the United States and Europe had begun to diverge in a sort of socio-cultural way. Many Europeans began to look at the United States and say, we don't recognize you as a fellow society or as a sort of fraternal society in the way we used to, in the sense that, you know, U.S. approach to the death penalty or the role of religion in U.S. life or U.S. social policies. There were a whole series of things on which the United States and Europe really began to seem to diverge quite significantly. You could put it in dramatic terms, just to sort of shake up your thinking. I think you could argue that on domestic social politics, the conservative, the most sort of left-of-center part of the U.S. Democratic Party is to the right of most European conservative parties. So the entire political spectrum in the United States on issues like maternity leave, death penalty, and so forth, is to the right of the entire European spectrum. It's puzzling. For example, in the United States, there's no paid maternity leave. And when most Europeans hear that, they think, you know, it was a big thing in the United States that they passed the right of women to have 4 weeks of unpaid leave if they have a baby. That's considered a huge breakthrough in the United States. The women now have 4 weeks of unpaid leave. There are only four societies in the world that don't have paid maternity leave. It's New Guinea, Lesotho, and I can't remember the other one in the United States. You know, the United States is an outlier in many of the ways in which it organizes itself socioculturally. And that was also underlying this rift in this decade. Now, what's interesting is that Obama represents to many Europeans a lot of European Obama mania. Is the sort of implicit belief that he's going to change that, and that he represents a sort of kinder, gentler approach to organizing society, being himself from a disadvantaged sort of minority. And the European assumption is that that's going to change, and I don't think it's going to change very much, because he is a centrist, and he's not going to spend his capital on these issues. And I'm not even sure that's really part of his agenda. So I think what we're going to see in this decade is that this divergence at the sociocultural level will continue, even though it will have a softer edge because Obama will be a much more appealing figure than President Bush. And to the extent that the United States is divided between blue and red conceptions of the society, Europeans are much more comfortable with the kind of, you know, what's usually called the coastal view of the United States rather than the heartland view. And Bush was, you know, the epitome of the heartland view. And Obama seems, although he's lived in Chicago, he's from as far as you can get in terms of coastalness, which is Hawaii. Not just California, but actually out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And so I think Europeans are going to be more comfortable with him, but they're going to be disappointed in the sense of convergence. Second point, I also agree very much, Charlie, that the United States is now going out in the world saying we need help. And the United States is on the ropes in many different ways, both domestically and in its foreign policy. What's interesting, and I think it's worth thinking about now, is that I think it's going to be very difficult for U.S. political culture, or the U.S. conception of itself, to change to match that. And I've been watching this as the financial crisis has hit. It's just very, very difficult for Americans to start, as you know, British people know from the experience of the 20th century, it takes a long time to adjust one's conception of one's sort of country and in a sense of oneself to a reduction in power. You have, I mean, in a funny way with the financial crisis, there's sort of this sense in the United States of, wow, this is a tremendous hit, but at least it's our crisis. I mean, we were the ones who caused it. That just shows American power. It's too bad mortgages in Florida and we wiped out the Russian economy. That just shows how, how powerful we are. I think the Russians are also wondering how so bad mortgages in Florida wiped out their economy. And so in an odd way, there's this interpretation that we're sort of actually still in the driver's seat. And I think there is not yet the realization within American society of how much the financial crisis will limit American foreign policy, because we've never really thought of our foreign policy as being financially constrained. We always have the idea that if it's necessary, we'll pay for it somehow. You know, the Iraq War was, of course, the classic example of that. There was no thought about how we would pay for that. We simply do it, and then we'll just pay for it in some fashion. And we are not yet, you know, I notice that even in sort of the circles that Charlie and I travel in the foreign policy community in Washington, we'll often sort of say, well, I guess this budget crisis is really going to hurt foreign policy. Then we kind of put it aside and just go about talking about all of the ambitious things we would like American foreign policy to do, with no real recognition of how it's going to be limited by that. And so I'm a bit worried that we're entering into a decade in which the disjunction between the American sort of self-image of itself and the reality of its power will get more fully out of synchronization than it's been. And that's usually dangerous, because usually countries that are in that situation make bad mistakes, and they sort of throw themselves about the international stage in ways that either look pathetic or dangerous to the rest of the world. So that concerns me. Third point I'd make, and I'll just make 4 points. The third point I'd make is about the bipartisan consensus and whether or not that can be reconstructed. I basically agree with what you're saying there, but I put it just a slightly finer point or sort of differentiate a little bit, is that I think what's happened is that it's puzzling in Washington because there are certain areas of U.S. foreign policy on which there really is a bipartisan consensus. Look at policy towards China. U.S. policy towards China has been the product of a bipartisan consensus for over 25 years. Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, George Bush Jr., they've all followed the same policy towards China. Because we have deep structural reasons we have to get along with the Chinese government, mostly financial and economic, but other reasons as well. U.S. policy towards India. Basically, U.S. policy towards trade. U.S. development policy. There are a series of areas in which the United States foreign policy is quite bipartisan still. But then there are areas where it's not. And if you try to draw a circle around the areas that are not and say, what's characteristic of these, what I see is, after the end of the Cold War, sort of the neoconservative movement, which emerged out of the end of the Cold War, attached its sort of ferocity about the Soviet Union to a new, smaller set of issues, but with the same kind of almost religiosity about its how much it cares. And so on issues like Cuba, we still don't have the ability to form a bipartisan consensus on Cuba because there are a certain number of people who just care so much about the U.S. sanctions on Cuba. You cannot have a rational discussion and say, here's a failed policy, it's failed for 50 years, it has achieved nothing, there's no rational reason to maintain this, and they'll say, that's true, but let's maintain these sanctions. And even the Obama administration is probably not going to lose the sanctions because of this, even though they know this would be the right thing, they know the signal it would send to Latin America, but it's not going to happen. Iran is another example. The idea of opening up a relationship with Iran just touches upon a nerve that is extremely hard. Now, that may be able to be done, but there will be a price to be paid. And you can go through. Georgia is another example, and you saw this in the political campaign with McCain. Russia and Georgia relations. Georgia is part of inside this circle in which it's just, you know, Georgia is a heroic small democracy being trampled upon by the Russians there, and no discussion about that. You cannot put forward an alternative view and say maybe mistakes were made on both sides, and maybe Georgia is an imperfect society, and maybe it's not in our interest to invest so much. No, you cannot have that discussion. And so it's really a series of things like that. And the war on terrorism, which flared up in this decade, unfortunately became a large zone of thinking of this sort of religious view of policy. Religious in the sense of dividing issues into not just right and wrong, but right and completely wrong. And that you can't really have calm discussions about them because there's issues on which people feel that you simply cannot cross this line. And so it's certain areas of U.S. foreign policy in which we cannot construct a bipartisan consensus, but not others. That's all I would say. And what's interesting is why some and not others. Final point I would make about the universalization of the Western liberal order and the change away from that is, I mean, first of all, I agree very much, and Charlie and I have written similar things critiquing the League of Democracies idea. But it's important to note that it depends a bit on what we mean by an international liberal order. There's sort of a minimal version and a maximal version. A minimal version of the international liberal order is a world bound by law, in which states obey law and interact with each other and are ruled in some sense by law. A maximal version is not just that they obey international law, but that their domestic practices towards their own citizens become harmonized over time by certain universal values. So they're both liberal internally as well as externally. And these are often sort of unclear what people mean when they talk about an international liberal order. And I think it's more complicated if we say, would rising powers like China and Russia and others want to take part in the Western liberal order? Because I think you could argue, or at least start an argument, that if all you're talking about is a minimal conception of an international liberal order, there may be a reason why some states would want to join that. China, for example, does apparently see some values in being part of an international legal order in certain ways, partly because if you're a rising new power, you would like a period of protection under some of these rules of sovereignty and non-use of force, and it's actually good for you to be part of such an international legal order as opposed to a predatory international order. At the same time, China very much rejects the maximal version because it doesn't want the outside pushing it on its domestic values and so forth. So I think it depends a bit on what we mean by that. Now, Charlie's referring really to the maximal version of a Western liberal order in which the Princeton Project was sort of imagining a world in which there's harmonization, both in terms of English legal practice abroad and at home within societies. But one final comment on that is I think we have to be careful when we talk about, and you hear this all the time in Washington now or in the United States generally, foreign policy discussions, the rise of, people say, well, you know, the rise of China and Russia and all these other non-Western powers and states, and that means greater political diversity and pluralism in the world. Actually, it's a bit more complicated than that, because what's striking is when you look at the rising powers, China and Russia are not democratic. All of the rest of them basically are. Brazil, South Africa, Argentina, Mexico, Indonesia, India. You go through and say, where's all the political diversity over there? Those are all basically Western democratic systems, in a sense, or they're at least democratic systems that follow basic principles of Western liberalism. And I think if you did a chart, I didn't have time to do this before this talk, but I was thinking about it on the way walking over here. If you took the list of the top 20 or 25 largest economies in the world today versus 30 years ago, I would argue, and I'm almost certain, that a higher percentage of them today would be democracies than 30 years ago. I think actually power is more distributed to democracies in the world today, and that will continue largely, except for the cases of China and Russia. And so what's puzzling actually is, you know, there's all this, there is the rise of non-Western powers, although I don't think of Latin America as non-Western really, but there is the rise of some non-Western powers. But it doesn't necessarily mean the rise of non-democracies other than the cases of China and Russia. And that's important. What's important, though, is when you look at the non-Western, the sort of democracies within that group, South Africa, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and so forth, they, although they're not democratic, they really don't like it when Westerners press them on their domestic political practices. They have a very strong attachment to sovereignty. And so what's interesting is there's a greater political commonality of values, but because of their traditional position in the non-aligned world or in the Cold War conflict, they came out of that experience with a very strong attachment to sovereignty, and that's why you see South Africa resisting efforts to push Zimbabwe and democracy and so forth. And so it isn't that they're non-democratic, it's that they're democratic, but they're quite attached to sovereignty and therefore willing to make deals with the Russians and Chinese when it comes to UN resolutions and things like that, because what they're all sharing is the principle of sovereignty, but they're not sharing a set of political values. So I think it's just important, again, to go one step further.
Okay, thanks, Tom, for those excellent comments.